from me, so he truly didn't know what had been done to him, except that it had hurt.
Lying defenseless in a pool of your own blood. I kept telling Theophilus that gunning you down was the simplest solution. How delightful to be proven right.
That's not his real name, is it? I asked.
Theophilus?
That's some kind of nickname he thinks is clever. Werner Drosha laughed at me.
Oh, you think I would ever tell you that? I would...
He cut off abruptly as a squad of shouty, armed men burst into the theater and demanded that he drop the gun now. He looked back over his left shoulder. But since he was flat on the floor, the result was that I saw the very top of his head for the first time. He had a rose cross there instead of an alchemical symbol. Strange.
Ah, sustenance,
Drosha said, grinning as he twisted to face the officers. He didn't move his right hand with the gun, but rolled a bit onto his right side so that he could stretch his empty left hand back at them, clutching at the air. He was trying to leech energy from the officers, first to heal and then to pump himself up to finish me off. But it didn't work, and the shouts got more insistent. Every second he held on to that gun increased the chances that he would be shot himself. But Drosha was stubborn, and perhaps a bit slow to realize his predicament, and just remained still, straining to do something he no longer had the power to do. The police converged, pointing their weapons at him, fingers on triggers, and eventually kicked away his gun. It skittered down the aisle as they grabbed his arms and yanked them behind him. Drosha finally realized he was a regular, powerless human, and his carefully cultivated arrogance evaporated. Being manhandled like the criminal he was caused him to lose his shit. He shouted curses in a mixture of German and English and struggled to free himself, but they had him cuffed in short order. That's when I called for help and got it.
He shot me,
I said weakly, and that's all I had to do. Drosha would go to prison after some cursory medical treatment, unless one of his vampire friends came to bust him out in the night. Regardless, he was simply human now, and I knew that would be a fate worse than death for him, after centuries of preying on people. Saying he shot me was all I could do anyway. I was fading fast. I'd been able to take care of single bullets on a couple of other occasions, but I'd also been able to access the Earth's power when I did so. 5 rounds and no juice meant I was completely dependent on modern medicine. Paramedics probed me and asked me questions that I tried to answer, but succeeded only in spewing out an unintelligible verbal slurry. They gave me plasma as I was trundled into the ambulance and whisked away to a hospital somewhere. The ride was almost absurdly short, a block away it seemed. But during the ride, it occurred to me that I'd certainly be staying the night in the hospital, most likely sedated, and if Drosha knew where I was and managed to make a call, he could summon his vampire buddies not only to spring him, but to take me out. Even if the police posted a guard on my room for some reason, a vampire would simply charm him or her and walk on past, ripping out my throat while I slept. As I slipped into unconsciousness before reaching a surgeon, I mouthed a prayer to the Morrigan that I get to wake up.
Chapter 6. With Loki's mark dissolved, I feel simultaneously free but hunted. Like prey, in other words. I can go wherever I want, with the proviso that someone could be, and probably is, watching. Surveillance state London, in other words. But instead of the government tracking my movements, it's anyone with a talent for divination. Loki is not particularly adept at that himself, but he knows people who are. He could still find me, and set me aflame, anywhere outside my warded cabin. That's the trouble with Earth-based wards. They don't travel well. It's what caused Atticus to bind cold iron to his aura. He couldn't think of any other effective way to ward against magic on his person. It's going to be a long process, doing that to myself. but after seeing how much the Fae hate it, I'm wondering if I should. Still, I think hiding from divination is a necessary safety measure, and something I should pursue now, considering my current enemy. Loki can't kill me if he can't find me. I don't want to ask Odin or any of his pantheon for help, though. The price they'd want me to pay would probably have something to do with their apocalypse, and the exchange of services would not be in my favor. The same would hold true of the Tuatha De Danann. Skawaja was a gift, but any further favors would come at a price, and they would be sure to ask for a heavy one. Atticus might have a decent suggestion for me, but I doubt he'd encourage anything beyond cold iron. I don't relish rehashing that conversation, and I don't know where he is right now anyway. That's the way I'd like to keep it for a while. I have things I want to do besides hide myself from the gods. I have old business to conclude with my stepfather. Orla and I are somewhere in Sweden now, deposited here by request via the Bifrost Bridge, after saying our farewells to Odin and Frick. We're on a lakeshore near some bound trees, and we can go wherever we want, but we pause to appreciate the view. There's some kind of hawk, or perhaps an eagle, hunting for fish. Distance makes identification impossible. It's chilly, and the sky is overcast. It looks like it'll snow soon. Orla's tail wags when I point out the raptor hunting for its lunch. It dives down abruptly and comes up with a squirming pike in its talons.
"Oh, food looks good,"
my hound observes, her tongue lolling out to one side. "Very subtle, Orla," I reply. "Let's go find some in India. I have someone I need to see there." I shift us to a familiar banana grove outside of Tanjavur, India, where it's much warmer than Sweden and the sun is shining. They often enjoy highs in the 80s during December.
"Remember this place," Orla said. "Mostly vegetables here. But Oberon brought me a ham bone. Oberon coming soon?"
"No, we won't see Oberon and Atticus for a while. But the market in town should be hopping, and I bet we'll find some chicken at least." We do indeed find some. And with basic needs met, I pull out my phone and launch a browser, spending a few futile minutes trying to find a current address for one Matini Palanichami, whose body Laksha currently inhabits. Time to act like the lost tourist I really am. I ask people who look friendly and willing to speak English how I might find a friend in town, feeling underdressed in my dull jeans and t-shirt in the midst of so many colorful saris. A Tamil university student sets me straight by telling me that the local search engines work fine, but are mostly in the Hindi or Tamil languages, neither of which I speak. I offer her my phone, and in moments she's found the most likely address and sets me up with a walking navigation map. I feel the eyes on me from men and women alike as I make my way to the Palanichami residence. And it's just as well that I don't speak the languages, or else I would probably have to open a can of whoop-ass on some men who catcall me. None of them approach, though, either owing to the presence of Orla at my side or the tomahawk at my belt. When I reach the address, my patience is tested further by the man who answers the door. He doesn't speak English and dismisses me rudely, slamming the door in my face without making any serious effort to understand why I'm there. I pound on the door with one end of Skawaja until he yanks it back open and shouts at me. "Matini," I say, and repeat her name until it penetrates, and he gives up his intimidation game. He shouts for her in the house, and eventually she appears at the door, both wary and weary. Her sari is blue and green, and her ruby necklace shines brightly against it. But her face is wan, even though the pallor of the hospital has improved to a healthier color. At least she brightens perceptibly when she sees me and says my name. A rapid argument with her brother or cousin or whoever the male is ensues, until he finally storms off, leaving us alone.
"Sorry about that," she says, stepping outside and closing the door behind her. "Martini's family is quite conservative."
"Hey, you sound good,"
I say, giving her a hug. When I last saw Laksha, she had a severe speech impediment due to her host body's brain injuries, but she had assured me she could work around it, and she had.
Thanks. It took a few days, but I have her rewired now. Had to work fast if I wanted to have any kind of say in my life.
Ugh, who was that, your brother? He had the distinct whiff of an asshole about him.
Yes, he's the brother. But they all have that attitude, unfortunately. Let's talk out of earshot. The father speaks English and is not above eavesdropping. The brother has gone to fetch him. He'll be out shortly to berate me for going outside alone, no doubt.
Alone? I'm here.
Alone with a stranger is worse than being actually alone.
We'll convince him that we're friends somehow. Laksha smiles, a bit crooked but relieved.
I'm so glad you've come to visit.
She greets Orla and gives her a scratch behind the ears. Without waiting for anyone's permission, we walk 2 blocks to a tea shop, and Laksha tells me on the way that Martini's mother works in the silk industry. Her father is an IT consultant who works from home serving clients in the UK, and her brother is a computer science major at the university.
And what about you?
Martini was about to get married, which was apparently to be the sum of her future. But then she got in that car accident that landed her in the hospital. I am very certain from what I could glean of her remaining memories that it was not an accident, but rather a suicide attempt.
What?
Her family is so very abusive. Not physically, I mean verbally. Lots of assertions that Martini is stupid and ugly and things of that nature. She didn't think their marriage would improve matters. And of course the marriage is off now. The man married someone else while she was in a coma. So at this point, I am reminded daily of how useless I am.
Well, that's bullshit, and you should move on.
I think Martini tried to do just that.
That's not what I meant.
I know what you meant, Granuel. But you are speaking from a place of tremendous privilege.
What? I'm not.
Hold that thought, please.
Laksha says as we arrive at the tea shop. They have 3 outside tables, and we sit at one, where Orla can join us. After we place an order, Laksha picks up the thread of our conversation.
Think about it, please. You have money, and the ability to go anywhere you wish on the earth without spending that money, plus significant physical abilities. These assets make you think it is simple for women to leave abusive situations.
I never said it would be simple, just that you should do it. And you have significant abilities too, Laksha. There's nothing keeping you here except your own will. If the situation is unbearable, then why have you decided to bear it?
Laksha shrugs noncommittally and looks down at her lap.
This is my karma.
I snort in disbelief. How do you figure that?
I don't know what happened to you that night with the Rakshasas and your father and Durga.
That's not a night I wish to relive. So I say, the short version is that I'm here and all the rest are not.
Yes. I'm sorry about your father.
Thank you.
Well, after my austerities and prayers, after all of my efforts to batter the Rakshasas, during the moment I was likely to do the most good, my help was firmly rejected.
Rejected? How?
I left my host buddy's mind, you see, to do battle with the Raksoyuj in the ether, as I promised you I would. And while I was in the ether, the woman died. I don't know how, for she was alive when I left. And Durga told me, not verbally, these were words I heard in the ether itself, that it was not my place to help, that my place was in my necklace. And then she forced me to return there.
Durga said that exactly? You're not paraphrasing.
She said that. And then my next memory is of you telling me to inhabit this body, or you would leave my necklace behind to be found by whoever walked by. So this is where I am supposed to be.
I shook my head. That doesn't follow. I told you to inhabit that body because it was the only one I could find on short notice. I was in a hurry, and that is all. I was not acting at Durga's instruction, and this was never intended to be a prison sentence for you. And I remind you that it's not a prison of any kind. You can leave that body right now, and you know it.
No. I am stained by my past, and regardless of your intent in the hospital, I know that this is where I belong.
You belong in an abusive household for trying to help me? I'm sorry, Lakshya, but I must reject that premise completely. Durga could not have meant that you are never to help anyone again. Why would she want that? Her words applied only to that situation, because you truly couldn't have helped with my father. The Raksoyuj was formidable, to say the least. I mean, Durga had to make an effort to kill him. He was a challenge. I'm sure she didn't mean for you to sit here and submit passively to some patriarchal toad for trying to help.
Lakshya bobs her head to either side, a non-committal gesture, and our tea and biscuits arrive. We spend a minute with the rituals involved in serving it, milk and honey, the clink of spoons on porcelain. And then Lakshya speaks again.
You have given me new information, and I'm grateful. I will consider it, I promise you, and act should I feel the need. You are right that I can leave at any time, but you are completely dismissing why I am staying.
I shake my head, uncomprehending.
No, I don't mean to be dismissive. I guess I don't understand.
Lakshya flashes a smile at me over her teacup.
That is both likely and easily forgiven.
Help me out a little bit?
She sips, savors the tea, and puts down her cup.
This is not my meek acceptance of systemic misogyny. I am not in need of your rescue. What I need is to atone for centuries, centuries, Granuel, of my own cruelty and arrogance. So, whether Durga meant for me to be here or not is immaterial. I feel I need to be here. To feel what it's like to be at the mercy of an arbitrary, power-mad individual, like I used to be. I am learning. I am becoming empathetic and understanding the horror of how I used to behave. This is where I am on my spiritual journey. Where are you on yours?
I flinch because the tone of her voice feels like a slap.
I'm not really on one. Gaia's my jam, and she's in favor of life on Earth, that's about it. Journey's over, I'm at my destination.
You haven't told me everything. You're different. Something else has happened to you besides the death of your father. What am I missing? Is it something to do with why you're holding your arm awkwardly?
Yes. She's missing what Loki did to me. And my determination to never let something like that happen again. Being at the mercy of an arbitrary, power-mad individual has very little to recommend it. I knew from experience with both Loki and my stepfather. But if she feels that it's necessary for her own personal growth, then my opinion doesn't matter. Still, her question and its answer shift my vision a little, allowing me to glimpse what she must be seeing. I'm much angrier and more aggressive than I used to be. And yes, I have cause, but the tragedy is that I've lost that giddy wonder I had when I first became bound to Gaia. There was peace, too, which I felt even while being pursued across Europe by Artemis and Diana. It's all gone now. You're missing why I came to see you, I say, knowing that she would recognize I wished to change the subject. I need a way to hide myself from divination, and wondered if you knew how I could make it happen. Lakshya grimaces at me, sucks at her bared teeth, and squints her eyes.
You think I can help you with that? I have absolutely no talent in that kind of magic. If I did, I wouldn't have been so surprised to see you.
But, oh, I guess you're just my go-to for advice. I had a problem, and I came to you first. Lakshya affects a southern accent, which she must have picked up while living in Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, ain't you just sweeter than peaches?
She drops it and continues more seriously.
Advice is easy enough. Go see those Polish witches we dealt with in Arizona, if you know where they are.
They put a cloak on your boyfriend's sword. I was able to remove it, because I'm quite good at destruction. But I could never create something like that.
Oh, duh! I should have thought of them. Yeah, they're actually in Poland now. Atticus convinced them to get out while they could.
And where are you now?
Still in Colorado.
In transition to Oregon, I let her know that the most reliable way to contact us is through the Tempe or Flagstaff packs, since we have ties to both.
I remember that, she says. If I leave here, I will let you know. But if I do, it will be for Martini's benefit, not mine.
I beg your pardon?
She's still in here,
Laksha says, pointing to her temple.
She is?
Laksha nods, a wan smile on her face.
I'm hoping to convince her to stay, rather than move on.
I'm intensely curious. How much of Martini is left after the trauma? Is Laksha capable of rebuilding what's lost? Is she talking to Martini regularly inside her head, like she used to do with me? But before I can ask any of these questions, a man shouts and rushes over to our table. Orla stands up and growls at him, and he pauses, but he doesn't back away. When Orla does nothing more, he spews a stream of annoyed Tamil at Laksha, or Martini, and I guess that this must be her father, who has left the house in such a hurry that he forgot to zip up his pants. He also hasn't shaven, or perhaps even showered for a couple of days. Yet he is doubtless telling Martini how wrong she is to be out in public without a proper escort. It sets my teeth on edge, and I want to growl at him too, but it's not my place to intervene. Laksha shoots a mute apology at me with her eyes, and I wave back in silence. As she rises from the table to leave, I glare at him, daring him to say or do anything that would allow me to give him a proper retort. But he just stares back, and then drapes a protective arm around the person he thinks is his daughter, steering her back to his house, where he can belittle her in private. Though I don't have anything but American money on me, it worked fine in the market, and I give the waitress everything I have, which is enough to pay for a month's rent, or maybe two. I figure somebody here should have a good day.
Chapter 7. Damn sheer hand to a dark and juicy hell for making me shift to an unfamiliar city to tend his perverted hound. I can't even bring Greta with me as a guide, because she told me once what happened to her old leader, Gunnar Magnusson, when he shifted planes. The poor lad was sick all over his shoes. Werewolves don't handle plane shifting well, and I can't ask her to suffer through that just to let a hound outside for a dump. Al Hauk pointed out that I didn't have to go. He could have called some pack that lived outside the city limits, and one of them could have driven into town to take care of Oberon. But Sheehan asked for me specifically. And besides, I'm curious about who could have put his bony arse in the hospital. Maybe I'll get to try out me new brass knuckles on him, or her, or it. So I shift into Queen's Park in Toronto with a sheaf of printed papers that Hal calls Google Maps, whatever the feck that means. And they're all marked up with arrows telling me where to go to get to the hotel and then a bunch of numbers to call to figure out which hospital Sheehan is in. Once I find him, Greta says he's officially using the name Sean Flanagan these days. I have another stack of maps telling me how to get there. I also have a handful of small pieces of paper with the number 20 on them and a picture of an old woman wearing a necklace of white beads. Greta says to me,
"These are Canadian,
and that if I give them to people in this country, they'll do what I want." When I ask her if that'll work on Sheehan, she says, "Probably not." It's mid-afternoon, and the walk from the park to the hotel takes me a half hour or so. I keep asking strangers if I'm heading in the right direction. They're a friendly and helpful lot, and I wonder if it has anything to do with the old lady on the small pieces of paper. The hotel is a tall building, which means a lot of stairs for me. Greta says the elevator is faster, but I don't trust them, because I don't know how they work. I know how stairs work, and that will be good enough. Jeanne's room is on the 6th floor, Hal told me. Room 633. When I reach it, I can hear the television blaring inside, and there's a sign on the doorknob that says Do Not Disturb. I figure that has to be a joke since Jeanne asked me to come here, but I don't think it's very funny. I try the handle, only to discover that it's locked. I pound on the door and call out to the hound. Oberon! Open the door if you can. It's on! His voice filters into me head. What are you doing here? Where's Atticus? Wait, how do I know you're really Owen? Because I can hear you talk and answer back. I'm here at Sheehan's request. He's been hurt and I'm to take care of you until he's well. Atticus is hurt? How bad? I don't know yet. I just got here. Would you let me in so I don't have to keep shouting through this feckin' door? Hold on. I can move the handle down, but you'll have to push it open because I can't pull. No thumbs. True to his word, the lock disengages and the handle, a short horizontal bar, moves down. I push it open and the giant wolfhound bombards me with questions before I'm even in the room. Where is he? Who hurt him? Are they dead yet? Or will they be dead soon? Can I help them die? I don't have details. All he did was text Hal Hawk in Arizona that he's in a hospital somewhere in this city. So we have to call around to find him. Is there a phone here?
Yes, next to the bed.
Good. When we find which hospital he's in, we'll go straight there and get some answers. The television is on and showing pictures of people eating way too damn loud. The hound shows me how to turn it off, and then we can concentrate in peace. The phone is an intimidating device, and it's full of instructions on the front, unlike cell phones. But it doesn't work like it should. Greta said when you use landlines like this, you get a dial tone first, and then you dial the number. Except when I start dialing, the feckin' thing starts ringing as soon as I punch the first number.
Room service.
A voice says in me ear. What? I'm trying to dial a hospital.
Pardon, sir. Is this an emergency?
Oh, not for me. I just need to make a call. And when I started dialing, you answered.
Oh, I understand. You need an outside line. Hang up, then dial 9. Wait for the dial tone, then dial your number.
I hate this feckin' sentry.
I beg your pardon?
I slam the phone down on the voice and pick it up again. There's a dial tone, but I do what the man said and punch 9. The tone skips a beat, then continues. I try the number for the first hospital again, and this time it works. Unfortunately, there's no one registered under the name Sean Flanagan at Mount Sinai Hospital, so the call is a waste of time. I move on to the next number, St. Michael's. The lady on the phone says, yes, Sean Flanagan is a patient there, but you can't give me any more information unless I'm a family member. I hang up on her rather than argue. I'll just go down there and see with me own eyes how he's doing. Right, is it St. Michael's? Consulting the Google map, I notice it'll take us a while to get there. It looks like a bit of a walk. You need a walk anyway, don't you? I ask the hound.
Yes, a walk would be good right about now.
Anything you need to bring. We won't be coming back here because I don't have the key.
I'm supposed to be on a leash in the city, but that's it. Everything else is Atticus's stuff. Oh, wait! He left his sword here. It's under the mattress. He's gonna want that.
I should imagine so. I retrieve it, strap it to me back, leash the hound, and leave the rest. Down the stairs we go, past some rather shocked people in the lobby who didn't know they made dogs in Oberon size. Once he's outside, Oberon informs me that he's gonna need to do some urban fertilization. Is that what you call it?
Boudica says my waste helps plants. It's science, which is great because I like peeing on them. I like to pee on streetlights and fire hydrants too, but it turns out that doesn't help them like it helps plants.
And what do you do when you have to shite in the big city?
Well, you're never supposed to do that on the sidewalk, Owen. That's rude.
Hey, I know that already. You don't have to tell me.
You hardly know how to use a phone or turn off a television, so obviously I can't assume you know these things. Since you didn't have sidewalks in your day, I thought maybe you weren't aware that they are not for shitting.
God's blasted, I was asking you where you shite in this city, not where I should do it.
I might have said that a bit too loudly, because people on the sidewalk look at me out of the corners of their eyes and swerve away from the man talking to a giant dog about where to drop a pound. Maybe I should talk to him the way Sheehan does, with me mind instead of me mouth. I can do it, but it doesn't come naturally. I never bound myself to an animal this way.
It depends on the city and the degree of my fecal urgency.
Fecal urgency? This is the strangest conversation I've ever had, and I've had some bloody strange ones lately.
The hound eventually takes care of his business behind a hedge we're passing, and then brags about his discretion.
Nobody will step in it there, and it will break down in a few weeks.
Well done, says I, thinking for 2 whole seconds that I'm going to have some pace before the hound speaks again.
I'm hungry, Owen.
That's too bad. I don't have any food on me.
But we're passing all these restaurants, and oh, I can smell the good things inside. You can go in and buy something. Please.
I start to object that I don't have one of those credit cards that people always use to pay for things. But then remember that Greta gave me the paper with the old lady on it, and something clicks. I pull it out and show it to the hound. Hey, do you know if this is cash money?
Yeah, those are Canadian dollars. Ooh, and you have a lot. You can buy plenty of food.
Who's this lady with the beads, then?
I think that's the queen. She was in the Naked Gun, which means those aren't beads, those are pearls.
I don't understand all of that, but at least I learned that Canada is ruled by a queen. All right, where should I go to get food?
This place, up ahead. Oh, I can smell the gravy.
He stops in front of a small shop with a large glass window painted with red and white letters.
Poutinerie, it says. What is a poutinerie? I asks him. It's an unfamiliar word.
I don't know, but they have gravy. There's something with gravy on it. I'll wait here like I'm supposed to.
There's a small line inside and a menu posted near the ceiling. I can't make any sense of it, except that it says all different kinds of whatever poutine is. Give me whatever's most popular, I says to the merchant when I get to the front of the line. As long as it has gravy on it.
Everything has gravy on it,
the young man says, his dull eyes and red spots on his face. But his tone sounds like he thinks I'm stupid. Good. 2 of your popular things, then. He asks me if I want a drink. I says water. Then he pronounces a number and looks at me like I'm supposed to do something. I give him Canadian money and he gives me some back. It has a number 5 on it and no queen. It has a dodgy man with a bald pate and a stiff white collar instead. Maybe he's the king of Canada. He also gives me a small white piece of paper and calls it a receipt. I have just completed my first modern trade. There's a short wait. Then I'm given 2 brown boxes with folding flaps on top and a bottle of water. I take this outside to the hound, open 1 box and set it down for him. Poutine? Turns out to be fried potatoes with cheese curds, all covered in gravy.
Oh, man, this is my new favorite thing!
Oberon says as she gulps it down. I have to admit that once I try my own, it's not bad.
Hunger slain, we proceed to the hospital, where the hound suggests that I camouflage him so that he can go inside with me. I figure I have plenty of juice in me knuckles, so I put him on, cast the spell, and we go inside together. I pretend to be Sheehan's father when I inquire at the front desk about him. The nice lady informs me that he's in something called the intensive care ward, recovering from surgery, but says I can't go any further wearing a sword. Well, balls to that. I tell her I'll go put it in me car, find the corner to duck around, and cast camouflage on myself, telling the hound to stay out of the way and I'll return soon with Sheehan. I walk back in, follow the signs to intensive care, and eventually find Sheehan's room. He's unconscious, or asleep, in a bed with metal rails on the sides, and he's got all manner of tubes and things in his nose and his arm. They're beeping noises and loud breathing, and none of it sounds natural. He's wearing a flimsy piece of cloth, and I don't see his regular clothes around. It's like they dressed him to look fragile. I don't think I should throw him over my shoulder in his condition. Somebody really did kick his arse. I reach out to Oberon with me mind. He might know what to do better than I. Oberon, can you hear me?
Yeah, did you find him?
Aye, but he's unconscious and has all these tubes in him. He's not walking out with me right now.
You need to get a wheelchair. Pull the tubes out if it won't make him bleed. Get him in a wheelchair and push him right out.
What's a wheelchair?
As you might expect, it's a chair with wheels on it. Helps you move people who can't walk. Look around in some of the rooms of the halls. You'll see one eventually.
That takes a bit more time than I would like. But the hound is right. One eventually comes along. A nurse wheels an old man into a room near Sheehan's and helps him into bed. He looks like he's about the age I was before I drank that tea Sheehan made for me. And his skin is dry and papery. He's asleep before the nurse is finished pulling up the sheets over his thin frame. I wait for her to leave, and then I cast camouflage on the wheelchair and steal it. A few minutes after that, I've stolen me a druid, and I'm out of the hospital with a camouflaged Sheehan in the chair. I drop the camouflage on myself and the hound as we walk away, but keep it going on me old apprentice. The hound gets more and more worried when Sheehan doesn't respond to him. Apparently he's never had his food reviews ignored before, and the discovery of poutine should have roused Sheehan right away. Eventually, I get Sheehan to Queen's Park and stop the chair right next to the bound tree I used to shift in. Looking around to make sure no one's watching, I drop his camouflage. Then I squat down and pull his right foot off the little metal shelf so that his heel can touch the earth again. Oberon thinks he should wake up immediately on contact.
"Why isn't he talking now?"
he asks.
If he can touch the earth, he should be able to heal, right?
Well, yes, but there's no telling how bad he is or what they did to him in there. Greta was telling me about modern medicine. Lots of drugs involved, and lots of it is synthetic shite they cook up somewhere. They may have knocked him out on purpose.
Oh, yeah, they do that. I've seen it on TV loads of times.
What he needs is a good long soak in the healing pools of Mamel. But I don't think I can shift ye there myself.
Why not?
I don't know either of ye well enough to carry ye along. I used to know Sheehan, but he's got 2,000 years on me. I'd worry about containing him. And, besides, I don't have the headspaces for it. I only have one extra, and Sheehan has, what, 3?
5 extra, I think.
Say, that's one feckin' impressive brain there. We get him awake, and he can shift both of us. The corner of Sheehan's mouth tugs upward, and his eyelids twitch a wee bit.
Oh, Owen,
he says,
though his voice is slow and slurred.
You're so sweet.
You're awake?
Just in time to hear you say something nice about me.
Well, don't let it go to your head. The truth is, your smarts are better hidden than a pair of snake nuts.
Atticus, I'm so glad you're okay. I have to tell you about this new thing I ate. It's called poutine and it's mostly gravy.
I'm definitely not okay over brunch. So tired. I'm groggy.
They have you pumped full of drugs, lad, I says.
Oh, there's a better word for drugs. It's called pharmaceuticals. That's 5 syllables, so I deserve some more poutine.
We need to get you to Ma Mel, I says. When do you think you'll be clear enough to shift?
Need a breakdown, chemicals. First.
It's a long couple of hours for the hound talking about food and his favorite entertainments after that. People passing by give us curious stares every so often, but they mind their own business, and I admire them for it. I shift away quickly to get the fancy steak Lukta made for Sheehan, and he doesn't even notice. When the sun goes down, it starts to get cold quickly, and that, along with the cleansing he's been doing, finally allows Sheehan to announce that he's ready. I have to help him up, and he winces. His right leg is shredded, but he shifts us all to Tiernanog, leaving a mystery wheelchair behind, and then to the plain of Ma Mel, where I carry most of his weight over to the healing pools, and he sinks into one with a happy sigh, tossing away that cloth he calls a hospital gown.
Ah, what day is it?
He asks, all the slurring gone from his voice. Same day, lad. What happened? We trade stories, and it makes me cringe to think of what these modern weapons can do to a body. It's a problem I'll have to consider, because he's right. His sword is no use against weapons like that, and neither are me shiny new knuckles.
Those are impressive, though, he says. If you can shatter rock with them, I wonder if they'd stop a bullet. Wouldn't want to try catching one, though. What are you going to name them?
I don't know yet. I take off his sword and place it next to his hand by the side of the pool, then give him the steak from Lukta as well. Look, lad, keep that vampire war as far away from me and Flagstaff as possible. We'll have a bunch of wee kids to look after soon.
Hal said as much. I'll try, but you should be aware that they may come after you to get to me, or to retaliate against something I do. Just ward and be wary.
I will.
And Owen?
His face is all scrunched up, as if he's expecting a beating for what he's gonna say next. What is it?
Maybe go a bit easier on them than you did on me.
It feels like ice water in me pants to hear him say that. I gasp, and everything retracts. But then I say, aye, lad, I will. There's silence for a few beats. And then I add, Greta would tear me up if I said a rude word to those kids. And their parents would join in, no doubt. I'll try not to repeat me cock-ups. His face relaxes and he smiles.
Fair enough. I'll try to keep mine to a minimum as well.
Good. Good. Eh? Speaking of Greta, I'd best be getting back to her. Go on to visit Briette for a moment. And then head home. You'll be all right now?
Yes, I appreciate you taking the trouble to bring me here.
He says farewell, and the hound thanks me for the poutine. I can tell he won't shut up about it for days. But Sheehan will have to listen to it, so I figure that stopping for food was a win for me in every way. The fae cart in Tiernanog doesn't operate on Canadian time, so it's hopping like a rabbit warren during humping season when I get there. There are quite a few of the dodgy sorts of fae around, far more than I'd seen before, and I wonder why that is. I hang back and listen, ask a couple questions, and learn that Briett has granted amnesty to a lot of fae and other old creatures that had either been imprisoned or exiled for a long time.
She's being more accommodating,
a winged fairy explains.
After Fan's attempted coup, we may have lost our queen, but at least the first among the fae is listening to us now, and Fan may return some day, just as these others have.
She's probably right about that. Fan won't remain in prison forever. The fae'll start asking soon when she might be released, and eventually their questions will turn into demands. And the same goes for her husband, Mananon MacLear. Briett can delay only so long before this temporary goodwill turns to ashes. But I'm not sure letting a bunch of prisoners free will do anything to keep the pace. Some of them are going to be grateful, sure, and be a grand addition to society. But some are going to be resentful and start throwing shite at things. She'd better be ready to duck. But perhaps Briett's thinking that she can simply imprison them again and say, well, I gave them a chance, didn't I? Not my fault if they're stupid gits. I find a chamberlain figure near the front of the crush of beans, dressed all fancy and doused in perfume. I tell him I'd like a brief audience with Briett, and his eyes stray down to me tattoos. They widen as he recognizes I'm bound to Gaia.
You're a druid,
he says. Aye. Owen O'Knady. She's left instructions to bring you before immediately, should you appear. Please come with me. That's a pleasant surprise, and I ignore the scowls I get from a group of pixie widows as the chamberlain interrupts their audience to introduce me, not just to Briett, but to everyone, since he shouts my name. I notice Briett's wearing a new kit. It's a set of lighter armor instead of the heavy stuff she wore during the coup attempt, painted a metallic blue. It leaves her arms and legs largely unprotected, but her vital organs are under wraps. And the area around her throne is warded tighter than a hedgehog's rolled-up arse, anyway. I can feel the bindings warning me away from it.
Welcome, she says. What news?
I'm starting a grove, taking on 6 apprentices to be druids. Wanted ye to know. Whatever protection ye can afford would be grand.
Ah, this pleases me very much, Owen. Give the details to my chamberlain, and I will see it done. I would speak longer, but I have much to do. Is there anything else?
I think of how Sheehan is trying to wipe out vampires, and it's going to be old blood and exploding organs until he's done. But she probably already knows that, since she had luck to make those stakes, and I don't need to announce it where everyone can hear. So I says, no, that is all. She bids me farewell, and I bow to her and chat off to one side with the chamberlain, while the pixies resume their audience. I tell him about the property in Flagstaff, and how it needs to be warded, and after a few seconds, become aware that something huge looms over us and smells like sweaty feet. A grey-skinned hulk, probably twice me size, stares down at me with tiny black eyes and big tusk-like teeth sticking up out of its mouth. There's a bit of drool leaking out the side, and there are also patches of lichen or fungus attached to its skin, with either mud or shite or both used as an adhesive. It has a cloth wrapped inexpertly around its hips, and it's doing a terrible job covering up the huge thing it's supposed to be hiding from view. It's a great feckin' bog troll, the kind that doesn't care if you see his cheesy dangly dong. The worst kind of troll, in other words.
I know you,
it rumbles, and its breath is a visible cloud of decay.
You're a druid.
You have a keen eye, I say. Would you excuse us, please?
No. We have business. I remember.
I don't think we do.
I was on the Time Island, released with many others. So are you, and you owe me gold.
You are mistaken. I don't owe you shite.
No mistake. You crossed my bridge in the bog and didn't pay the toll. You look younger now, but I remember you owe me gold.
When he says that, it triggers me own memory. He's right. In the old days, I'd been crossing a bog on my way to visit a cousin, when this troll pops up in the middle of it and demands that I pay him to cross the rest of the way or it's over the edge for me. I had no gold and no intention of paying if I did, so I cast camouflage and snuck past him. The troll had cursed me and promised someday he'd make me pay, and I told him, from a distance, that no one's bollocks should ever smell that bad. Why, Brett thought relation trolls would make anything better, I cannot fathom. It would only lead to situations like this, bullying people going about their business. This one's attention had no doubt been drawn when the Chamberlain announced me as a Druid of Gaia. Now he knew my name, and quite possibly where I lived, if he'd been listening in to our conversation. To make him go away, I pull out the Canadian money Greta gave me, and thrust it at him. There, I says, take it. His eyes shift to me hand, his mind churns like thick pudding, and he finally says,
"That's not gold."
"It's better than gold, lad. It's got the Queen of Canada on it. And she walks around wearing pearls, see? It's like her neck is sweating wealth. And look here, this one has the King of Canada on it. Serious man there, you can tell by his collar, and this is serious money. You can buy anything with this, and it's a good deal more than any toll I've ever heard of."
"It's only paper. Worth nothing. You owe me gold."
"I don't have any feckin' gold, do I? This is all the money I have, so you'll have to take this or nothing."
"You bring me gold tomorrow."
"You take a bath first," I says, and walk away, shoving the money back in me pocket. The troll won't throw any punches in the fair cart, but I see as I push through the crowd that there are several other trolls present, and their eyes all follow me as I edge to the perimeter of the cart's meadow, where there are bound trees that I can use to get out of there. I recognize some of those trolls. Ugly is hard to forget sometimes, and they no doubt recognize me. I'm the guy who never pays to cross a bridge. "Why are there trolls at the fae cart anyway? They're not creatures given to carts of any kind. They must have a problem and are hoping for an audience of their own. Their bogs and rivers and bridges are probably all gone by now, and they can't make the same living that they did in the old days. But I represent that old living to 'em, and they want to hold on to it more than anything, I expect. People do that. Cling to their past, because it's the only thing they consider safe. Trying something new, or just accepting it, turns their livers into jelly."
"But that's a load of bollocks. You take the new and appreciate it if it's good, like whiskey, or poutine, or girlfriends who bite. Or you dismiss it as shite if it's bad, like cell phones and cars, and move on. Of course there's people like Sheehan too. He does everything he can to escape his past, but can't seem to do it. He has a lot more past than the average lad, though. Maybe that's why he looks so feckin' hunted all the time." When I reach the trees, I look back and see the trolls are still watching me.
I smile and wave to them before I shift away. They couldn't come after me that way. They have to use the old ways to get to Earth, and there aren't any of those in North America. They'd never get any gold out of me. Time to leave the past in the past, boys.
Chapter 8. I nodded off in the healing pool. Fairly safe, since the attending fairies come to the rescue if your head slips underwater. But I wasn't safe from getting splashed in the face, and neither was Oberon, who drifted into slumber behind me. Both of us got a rude awakening.
But hey!
Oberon said.
What the... Oh, shutting up now.
When I blinked away the water, I saw that I wasn't alone in the pool anymore. A woman with jet black hair and marble white skin sat across from me.
Hello, Sheehan,
she said in a throaty rasp.
Morgan? You're alive?
Quite dead. Yet I cling to a different kind of existence, thanks to those who still worship me. Far easier for me to manifest and visit you on this plane.
Is something wrong? Is this the end?
No. It's not the chooser of the slain visiting you at this time. It's a reminder that you have work to do that you haven't been doing.
Ah. Is this visitation but to whet my almost blunted purpose?
An odd way to put it, but I suppose so,
she replied, completely missing the allusion to Hamlet.
You must visit the Svartalfs, and do it soon.
How soon? I'm getting better, but I'm still a little messed up here.
Tomorrow they will be attacked. You must prevent it.
Attacked by whom?
Dwarfs. Aesir.
Aesir? As in Odin and Freya?
No, none of the gods, but they have full knowledge of what's to be done.
So by intervening, I'll be contradicting the will of Odin?
Yes, but that's never bothered you before.
It's just that we're supposed to be working together now. I gave him whiskey and Girl Scout cookies. We're practically bros.
That shouldn't change, Sheehan. The point is to get the Svartalfs working with you as well.
I shook my head at the enormity of the task. There are centuries of prejudice there on both sides. Lots of mistrust. It'd be like asking the Firbolgs or the Fomorians to work with the Tuatha De Danann on a friendly basis. Turning enemies into allies in a day sounds impossible.
It is fortunate, then, that you don't have to do that in a day. Merely prevent genocide so that trust can begin to build.
Did you say merely prevent genocide?
That's something you can do in a day, Sheehan.
She slid forward through the water and planted a cold kiss on my cheek, while her sharp, frigid fingernails rested on my throat.
Don't disappoint me.
Morrigan, the dark elves have tried to kill me recently, on multiple occasions. I don't think they'll accept me as a diplomatic envoy.
Go, anyway.
And her fingers tightened on my throat, drawing blood under her fingernails.
Unless you'd like me to visit you again as the Battle Crow.
Well, no, I can't imagine why I'd want that. She sank into the water and melted away in it. The visitation abruptly ended. I checked. No one in the pool but me. She's gone, I said, mostly to myself, but Oberon thought I was talking to him.
I'm glad. I know she gave me food once, but she still scares me.
That's okay. She scares me, too. I needed to get moving, but realized that while I had a sword and a stake and a hound, I had no clothes. The fairies attending the healing pools had taken my hospital gown. I called one over and asked if she might do a couple of things for me. "Please tell Briet I'm here," I said, "and need to speak with her on an urgent matter regarding the Morrigan." That should bring her running.